The Boeing 727 sits on the tarmac under harsh airport lights, its aluminum belly gleaming. It's late afternoon, November 24th, 1971, Thanksgiving Eve. Inside the terminal, cigarette smoke hangs in the air. Men and women stand at push-button payphones, checking in with family before boarding. The paperwork moves through microfilm readers in dim back offices. Nothing unusual, nothing that signals what comes next. A man in a dark suit boards the flight with a briefcase. He gives his name to the attendant, Dan Cooper. He takes his seat near the back. The plane fills with ordinary passengers heading home for the holiday. And then, as the flight climbs into the darkening sky, everything changes.
Welcome to Unexplained History. I'm Tom McKenzie. Each week, we dig into moments that still puzzle investigators, witnesses, and the public. This season, we're following a case that has never fully closed, and one that forced ordinary people to confront an extraordinary choice made at 30,000 feet. You'll find the full archive, plus bonus material and research notes, wherever you get audiobooks. Today, the demand that changed everything.
The note was written on the back of an airline napkin. It said, "I have a bomb. It's in my briefcase. I want $200,000 and four parachutes." The man who called himself Dan Cooper handed it to flight attendant Florence Schaffner. She read it. She looked at him. She understood in that moment that she was no longer a flight attendant on a short commuter run. She was standing inside a crisis that had no template, no procedure, no certainty about how it would end.
What we know is stark and simple.
On November 24, 1971, Northwest Orient Flight 305 took off from Seattle, bound for Portland. Within 30 minutes of takeoff, a passenger claimed to have a bomb and demanded $200,000 and four parachutes. The pilot reported the threat to authorities on the ground. Law enforcement mobilized. The airline made contact with the bank. The money was counted and packed. The parachutes were gathered, and the plane, with 36 passengers and crew aboard, continued to circle in the night, waiting. The attendant who received that note was left holding knowledge that would reshape the rest of her life. She carried the memory of fear in a confined space, the sound of the cabin, the faces of passengers who did not yet know what was happening. For years afterward, whenever she heard the hydraulic whine of an airplane's equipment, her body would tense. She would feel that moment again. The napkin in her hand, the words written in blue ink, a man sitting calmly in 18C asking for what seemed impossible. She would be asked to speak about it many times. Reporters wanted details. Television producers wanted her on camera. Each request pulled her back into that November evening. She would eventually decline most interviews, choosing instead the kind of quietness that lets a person move forward. But she never forgot the weight of that knowledge, that she had been the first to know, the first to carry the burden of a threat that no one else in the cabin had heard. By midnight, the demand had been met. The money sat in a bag. The parachutes were loaded onto the aircraft. The man had made one final condition. The plane would stay airborne. Somewhere over the forests and ridgelines between Seattle and Portland, flying low and slow, the cabin door would open. And a man carrying $200,000 would step into the dark.
So, how does a routine ticket purchase and a short flight lead to an overnight jump over dark ridgelines? Before the plane became a crime scene, there were small decisions. A name chosen for a ticket, a note folded inside a briefcase, and a person working an ordinary shift at a Portland counter who would spend years wondering about the sale they'd just made. Let's go back to the hours before takeoff and follow the trail of paperwork and planning that investigators would later use to build their case.
The ticket was bought under an assumed name, not unusual for 1971. Airlines didn't require ID to purchase a flight then. What mattered later was the specificity. Someone had walked into a travel office in Portland and paid cash for a one-way ticket on Northwest Orient Flight 305, set to depart Seattle that same afternoon. That ticket seller would never forget the transaction, though at the time, it seemed routine. When the Portland ticket seller processed that sale, they had no way of knowing what came next. For months afterward, the seller felt a weight settle in. Not guilt exactly, but a kind of unease, a transaction that preceded a crime. Years later, when journalists and researchers came calling, asking to photograph them or dig deeper into that morning, the seller refused. They gave only careful, limited statements. The encounter had changed something, left a mark that didn't fade.
So someone walks into a travel office with cash and walks out with a ticket. But what happens next tells us more about the thinking behind it all.
Inside that briefcase was a note, simple, direct. It contained instructions and a single demand that seemed to require specific knowledge about aircraft. The note would become central evidence. The Federal Bureau of Investigation opened what they called NORJR, their investigative code name for the case. That acronym became shorthand for a probe that would run for decades, consuming resources and attention in ways few unsolved crimes ever did. From the beginning, the Bureau treated every detail of that ticket purchase and that note as proof of planning. Not impulse, not desperation, premeditation. The microfilmed paperwork from those early hours, ticket stubs, manifests, receipts, preserved a trail. Flight attendants would later recall a man who was calm and quiet when he handed over his briefcase and made his demand. Investigators pored over these documents, looking for patterns. They solicited the public for any physical evidence related to the flight or the person involved. They revisited files repeatedly over the years. Even when other leads dried up, the Bureau kept the case alive. In 2016, more than 40 years after the flight, they redirected active resources toward NORJAC once more. The demand for answers never stopped. What strikes investigators about the note itself is what it asks for. Four parachutes. Not one, four. Money, yes, but also parachutes. As if the person understood something specific about how an escape might work. The choice of four raised questions that would echo through the entire investigation. Was this someone trained? Someone with knowledge of aircraft and equipment? Or was it a guess? A request that sounded reasonable but revealed ignorance to those who knew better.
Why four parachutes? And what did that request tell investigators about the hijacker's competence and intent? By mid-afternoon, on November 24th, the aircraft had been on the ground in Seattle for just under an hour. Passengers were boarding and deplaning. Cargo was being loaded. But inside the cabin, something far more deliberate was happening. The man with the briefcase was about to disappear into the night. But first, he had to get from one city to another. And that journey, the flight itself, would be the moment everything came down to wind, darkness, and timing.
Seattle-Tacoma International Airport sits south of the city, a flat expanse of tarmac and concrete. On that November afternoon, ground crew swarmed the Boeing 727. The first set of passengers got off, the second set climbed aboard. The exchange took maybe 20 minutes. For most travelers, it was routine, another leg on the way to somewhere else. But the man with the briefcase had no intention of arriving in Reno. One of the passengers on that Seattle exchange would later tell investigators and journalists that the cabin felt tense. People were quiet, the crew was professional, but there was something in the air, a weight that passengers picked up on. without fully understanding why. That passenger would spend years afterward reluctant to retell the story in public. Media attention came and went, and so did the requests from amateur investigators. Over time, the memory became something they kept largely to themselves, not out of secrecy, but out of frustration. The uncertainty never went away, and neither did the questions.
The plane refueled. The crew remained minimal. Just the flight crew and a stewardess.
Around 7:40 to 8 p.m., the 727 pushed back from the gate. The flight was heading to Reno, Nevada. It would be a night departure into weather that was already beginning to deteriorate. The man took his seat. Two parachutes remained in the cabin. The stairs, the aft air stair that passengers normally use to board and exit, was still folded up inside the fuselage. That would change within the hour. The technical realities of what came next are worth understanding. A Boeing 727 has several ways to get people in and out. The front door is used during normal boarding. The aft stairs are hydraulic. They lower from underneath the tail section. Once you lower them at altitude, the aircraft experiences drag. The airflow changes. The cabin pressure shifts. For a commercial airliner carrying paying passengers, you never lower those stairs in flight. There is no reason to. But on this night, someone would lower them deliberately. The conditions outside were dark. Southwestern Washington in late November at night presents a landscape of fir and pine ridgelines, river valleys, and sparse settlement. Cloud cover was building. The visibility was poor. The man looking out a window would have seen almost nothing, just cloud, and below that, the vague shapes of terrain in darkness. None of the crew knew his real name. None of them knew where he was about to go. They knew only what he had told them. He wanted money, parachutes, and a flight to Mexico City. The plane was heading south. He had what he needed. The hydraulic system engaged. The aft stairs hissed and began to lower. At that moment, the aircraft was at a certain altitude, flying at a certain speed over a certain part of the landscape. Everything that happens next, the jump itself, the descent through cloud, the landing, depends on those three pieces of information. And the truth is, we have estimates for all three, but estimates are not certainties.
So the question becomes, given the night conditions, the cloud cover, and the plane's position when those stairs opened, where could he actually have landed? Within hours of the plane landing in Reno, the FBI's response machinery kicked into high gear. This wasn't going to be a quiet investigation confined to one office or one city. What unfolded was a sprawling institutional effort, and it left a trail that would shape the case for decades to come.
The NORJAC task force mobilized across multiple FBI field offices. Agents in Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco received urgent dispatches. Each office staffed teams tasked with specific angles. Financial records, airline employees, known associates of similar crimes. The coordination itself became part of the institutional footprint. Memos typed out, logged, filed, and cross-referenced. A critical piece of that machinery was the ransom money itself. The FBI had prepared a list of serial numbers for each of the $20 bills. That list was printed, duplicated, and distributed widely to banks, post offices, hotels, casinos, anywhere large cash transactions might occur. The idea was straightforward. If the money began circulating, it could be spotted and traced. On the ground, search operations commenced in earnest. Teams swept ridgelines in the Cascades. Others worked the Columbia River shoreline, moving methodically through brush and sand as the Pacific Northwest autumn gave way to rain and fog. The scale of the effort was immense. dozens of agents, local police, volunteers, all operating from a basic premise: find the jumper, dead or alive, and recover evidence.
One of the voices anchoring those early decisions was Larry Carr, an FBI official who helped frame the agency's assessment of survival odds.
Larry brought a measured, analytical approach to the question everyone was asking: could a person survive that jump? His statements, cautious but clear, became the public reference point for how the FBI viewed the probability. Jump from a 727 at night into terrain like that, with those conditions, and the odds weren't in anyone's favor. That assessment shaped the tone of official briefings. It shaped how reporters covered the story. It shaped how the public began to think about what might have happened in the darkness above the forest. But Larry's role was more than just prediction. As the case drew media attention and public curiosity intensified, he became a go-to source when journalists sought authoritative context. He spoke to reporters, answered follow-up questions, and served as a steady voice when rumors and speculations swirled. That shift, from behind-the-scenes risk assessment to public commentator, marked a change in how he engaged with the investigation. The case was no longer just an internal matter. It had become a public narrative, and Larry was helping to shape it. Meanwhile, the serial number distribution continued to work its slow, methodical course. Year after year, that list remained in circulation. Banks kept copies. Businesses had them pinned to walls. No one knew when or if those bills might surface, but the infrastructure was in place. The institutional machinery had created a paper trail that would outlast the initial flurry of activity and searches.
So, who were the people at the center of this investigation? And how did their voices and choices shape the public story we came to believe? Most big discoveries in criminal history come from investigators working leads. But sometimes the biggest clues arrive by accident, handed over by someone who wasn't even looking. On a winter day in 1980, that's exactly what happened on a beach along the Columbia River.
February 10th, 1980, the Columbia River shoreline near Tina Bar. Rain had been falling for hours. The wind came in gusts, peeling back the bank and exposing things that had been hidden for years. A child walked along the wet sand, moving through the spray and the cold. And then, a packet, then another. Soggy bills, their edges worn and discolored. $20 notes, dozens of them, still bundled together. The bills found their way to authorities. FBI agents compared the serial numbers against their list. The match was immediate and unmistakable. Approximately $5,800 of the ransom money, money that had vanished the night of November 24, 1971, was now in official hands again. Brian Ingram was the young finder. He was surprised, then confused, then careful about what came next. When investigators contacted him, Brian answered their questions, but he kept his answers brief. He didn't seek out reporters or dwell on the discovery. He understood, even as a child, that he'd pulled a thread in something much larger than himself. And once investigators began asking where exactly he'd found the bills and how they'd come to rest at that spot, the questions grew harder to answer with certainty.
What does a discovery like that really tell us?
The money was real, the serial numbers were verified, but the story of how it traveled from that aircraft to a riverbank 9 years later remained uncertain. Water moves, banks shift. A packet of bills could be buried for years and exposed in hours. It could have drifted downstream from a point miles away, or it could have been placed there by someone carrying it all along. What the discovery did accomplish was unmistakable. It reawakened public attention. It reminded people that the case was not settled, not closed, not forgotten. And it placed a burden on one person, a young finder who simply wanted to do the right thing and hand over what he'd found. Brian didn't ask for scrutiny. He didn't request to become part of the historical record. But he was, and he carried that quietly. The physical objects connected to this case tell a different kind of story. The parachutes themselves, the training rig that was sewn shut, a cord tied the ransom bag to one of those parachutes. A single black clip-on tie sat in the evidence trays, collected and labeled. These are the artifacts, the traces of a person and a moment frozen in time.
So, if small amounts of recorded bills appeared years later on a riverbank, what does that say about the jumper's fate and the money's path? By the 1990s, forensic science was transforming criminal investigation. DNA testing promised answers that fingerprints and eyewitness accounts could never deliver. But when old evidence gets new attention, the lab doesn't always tell the story we hope it will. For Norjak, that tension between hope and scientific reality would become the through line of decades to come.
In evidence rooms across the country, old cases sit waiting. Filing cabinets hold parachute material, fragments of cord, and ordinary objects that seemed unremarkable when they were first collected. One of those objects was a black clip-on tie. It had been removed from evidence and, decades later, submitted for DNA analysis. The tests came back. But the results did not settle anything. The FBI cautioned that the tie's provenance was uncertain. Who had handled it over the years? How had it been stored? Was it contaminated? Did it contain material from multiple people? These questions mattered as much as the DNA itself.
Contamination. That's the real obstacle, isn't it?
Yes. A tie worn in 1971, handled by officers, stored in filing systems, moved between locations. It collects DNA like a magnet collects dust. A hair from an investigator. Skin cells from a clerk. The biological signature of someone decades removed from the crime itself. Modern laboratories are sensitive enough to detect these fragments. But sensitivity and accuracy are not the same thing. The Norjak investigator faced a particular frustration. For years, public interest had centered on hope. Hope that new science could reopen old doors. Television shows made DNA seem like a magic answer, but in the evidence room, the reality was messier. The investigator kept detailed notes on who had touched each item, when and how it had been preserved, not out of confidence that one test would solve everything, but out of professional duty to the record itself. What emerged from the forensic work was caution, not closure. The tie had yielded material. Profiles existed. But linking those profiles to a named suspect required something the lab could not provide alone. An independent way to narrow the field, to rule out contamination, to distinguish the signal from the noise.
So what threshold of evidence could actually identify the jumper at this point?
That became the question that would haunt the case into the new millennium. Physical evidence, once discovered and examined, raises more questions than it answers when its chain of custody is incomplete or when the evidence itself bears the fingerprints of time.
If DNA evidence is contaminated or multi-sourced, what standard of proof could truly identify the jumper? For decades, One question has drawn believers and researchers back to the case again and again. What if he survived? Today we're hearing from people who built that case and why the absence of a body kept hope alive.
In the decades after 1971, a peculiar silence surrounded the case. No parachute was ever recovered, no body washed ashore. The Columbia River yielded nothing conclusive. No remains, no gear, no final answer. For many, that silence became room for possibility. Families and amateur historians began to ask questions. What if he'd chosen his landing zone carefully? What if he'd studied the terrain, the weather, the escape routes? The dark fir and pine ridgelines of southwestern Washington offered cover. A man moving at night, in rough country, could disappear entirely.
You looked at the evidence yourself. What did you find most compelling?
In 1980, a boy found $5,800 of the ransom money along the wet, wind-whipped Columbia River shoreline at dusk. The bills were partially rotted but traceable. To believers, this wasn't an ending. It was a breadcrumb. Someone had buried the cash. Someone had come back for part of it. The rest remained hidden, waiting. Researchers combed through reported sightings across the Pacific Northwest. A man fitting the description seen in Oregon. Another spotted in Canada. None verified, but the reports accumulated. They felt like traces, clues left by someone living under an assumed identity, staying careful, staying hidden. For a family who believed one of their own might be connected to this story, the burden was profound. They faced public scrutiny, journalists called. Online forums debated their relatives' life and choices. The emotional toll of defending a narrative you cannot fully prove, of hoping season after season that documents might surface or DNA might confirm, that weight never lifted. Gradually, that family shared records with researchers. Old photographs, travel documents, letters. They participated in interviews, pressing for further investigation, seeking dignity and explanation for a person they believed might have existed in the shadows of this case. They were not looking for glory, they were looking for truth. The believer case is not built on certainty, it is built on absence, the absence of remains, the absence of a clear ending. It is built on circumstantial details. Timing, geography, recovered money, reported sightings. Each piece, alone, is inconclusive. Together, they form a narrative that feels plausible to those who hold it. And that narrative has endured because it answers a human need, the need for a story that doesn't end in tragedy alone.
But here's what we haven't tested yet. Can those survival scenarios actually hold up against what we know about the conditions that night, the weather, the altitude, the equipment he carried? Given the believer case, can physics and field evidence actually accommodate a plausible survival and escape scenario? The night was dark, the clouds hung low, and a man with a parachute stepped into the unknown. But did he survive what came next? Let's walk through the physics and the hard constraints that shaped what happened in those final moments. Because the story we believe often depends on what the equipment, the weather, and the human body could actually do.
10,000 feet, 196 to 200 miles per hour. Those are the numbers that forensic specialists keep coming back to. On a night in November, when clouds filled the air below 5,000 feet, a man jumped from a Boeing 727 over southwestern Washington. The dark fir and pine ridgelines below were invisible in that darkness, so were the terrain hazards he couldn't predict. Here's where the physics starts to press. At that altitude and that speed, a parachute doesn't have much time to stabilize. The air is thinner. The body is moving fast. And if something goes wrong, a malfunction, a landing on rock instead of soft ground, a collision with a tree, there's no margin for error. The county forensic specialist applied conservative models to evaluate survival probability. What she found was not encouraging.
What made those numbers so sobering?
The man had chosen a training parachute, not a sport rig. Training chutes are reliable for student jumps from safe altitudes and slower speeds. They are not optimized for rapid deployment or rough terrain. At near highway speed, descending through clouds into forest at night, a training chute became a liability. The model suggested that landing impact at that velocity would produce injuries consistent with non-survival. Not certain death. Physics is not that clean, but a survival rate low enough that betting on it was betting against evidence. But here is where the human story and the forensic story began to diverge. The specialist encountered public pushback from advocates for more hopeful readings. People wanted to believe escape was possible. They held onto narrative threads, reports of a second parachute, sightings in Canada, the idea that a practiced jumper might have trained for exactly this. The specialist saw something else, a case as a lesson in evidence-driven restraint. She published technical summaries for peer review. She kept public commentary limited to measured findings. No theatrics, no absolutes. Just, here is what the data permits us to say, and here is what it does not. That discipline mattered, because it meant that when evidence did surface, like the money recovered at Tina Bar in 1980, approximately $5,800 in bills, there was a credible framework for weighing what it meant.
The money changed things, though. It gave the case something concrete, something physical.
It did. And as we'll see, that discovery and the legal questions that followed about chain of custody and provenance would reshape how the public understood survival itself. But first, the skeptical case had to be heard, that the physics of that night, the choice of equipment, the clouds, the airspeed, all of it stacked the odds against a man walking away unharmed.
So, if the skeptical case is strong, why did the public and some investigators continue to treat survival as plausible? Over 50 years, the Noor-Jack case moved from an active investigation to something else entirely. A cultural artifact. Books, documentaries, amateur researchers, and endless speculation kept the story alive long after official resources shifted elsewhere. But what's the human cost of that legacy? And what would it actually take to restart the work?
Picture a filing cabinet in a federal building. Inside are decades of typed memos, field logs, and careful notations, the paper skeleton of a case that consumed thousands of hours. Outside, the Columbia River still moves cold and swift through the same ravines where evidence surfaced in 1980, and where amateur treasure hunters have searched ever since. The 1980 discovery of parachute material near Tena Bar did more than provide a potential clue. It reignited public appetite. Books appeared. Television crews returned. Retired agents were interviewed. Hobbyists and researchers began their own campaigns, often with good intentions, but sometimes at the cost of families who wanted the chapter closed.
The Bureau faced a difficult position.
In 2016, the FBI issued public guidance. The Bureau redirected active resources away from Noor-Jack in July of that year, but asked the public to submit any newly surfaced parachute or ransom money-related physical evidence. It was a careful balance, acknowledging decades of public interest without promising that tips would trigger full reopening. For the FBI spokesperson tasked with communicating those decisions, the challenge was profound. They had to explain why active resources were being withdrawn while still encouraging the public to come forward. They faced frustrated amateur researchers, hopeful descendants, and a media landscape that treated speculation as news. The emotional weight of that role, maintaining professionalism while being bombarded with theories, some plausible and many not, changed how that office approached engagement with cold cases. What emerged was a framework. The spokesperson and the Bureau established clear criteria. A single, properly documented parachute fragment would be pertinent. Ransom bills recovered in unusual circumstances would warrant evaluation. Physical evidence tied to the jump site or the money would be retained in archives for future forensic review. But speculative sightings, reinterpreted old photographs, or anonymous tips would not trigger reinvestigation. The behavior shifted from reactive to structured.
That restraint reflects something important. The ethics of resource allocation in a system with finite people and budgets.
Every hour spent chasing unfounded rumors is an hour not spent on cases where leads remain active, where witnesses are still reachable, where forensic techniques are still evolving. The Norjak legacy includes a reckoning with that reality. Public obsession, however genuine, does not obligate law enforcement to continue active work indefinitely. At the same time, the Bureau chose not to close the door. Archival storage meant that new evidence could still be evaluated. Guidance meant the public knew what evidence would matter. The question that lingers is not whether Norjak will be solved, but what kind of newly surfaced verifiable physical evidence would compel Norjak or another authority to resume active investigative work. A single, well-documented item, a piece of the parachute system recovered in unexpected terrain, or bills tied to the ransom through provenance research, could reframe investigative priorities and pull resources back to the case. Until then, the legacy remains one of balanced restraint and cautious hope.
What would evidence have to look like, and who decides whether it's real? We've traced this case from a single demand on an airplane to 50 years of investigation, speculation, and careful skepticism. Now we arrive at the practical question that investigators still grapple with. What would it actually take to move forward? Let's talk about evidence and what counts as decisive proof.
When investigators consider reopening a cold case, they work from a practical ledger. For this hijacking, the FBI has been clear about what would move them. Fragments of the parachute bearing recoverable fibers or markings, money from the ransom with clear documented history, or human remains linked forensically to the case. These are not wishes. They are thresholds built on decades of prosecutorial experience. That distinction matters because of a case that came just 1 year later. In 1972, another man boarded a Boeing 727, made a similar demand, and jumped with money. His name was Richard Floyd McCoy Jr. Unlike the first case, investigators recovered physical evidence, money, and confession statements that allowed them to identify him, prosecute him, and secure a conviction. The McCoy case teaches a hard lesson. Similar crimes can be solved when the evidence exists to prove them.
So, what changed between then and now?
Modern forensic standards are far stricter than they were in 1971. A tie found in a warehouse 50 years ago, even if DNA was recovered from it,
cannot definitively identify anyone without unbroken chain of custody and confirmed single source attribution. That means someone must prove that the item was always stored correctly, never contaminated, and that the DNA belongs to one person alone. Ambiguity disqualifies it from courtroom use. This is not a flaw in the system, this is its strength. Prosecutors and forensic experts have learned from wrongful convictions that certainty demands rigor. They would rather leave a question open than prosecute on fragile proof. That caution protects everyone, the guilty and the innocent alike. If parachute material or clearly documented bills were to surface tomorrow, here is what would happen. First, the material would be photographed and formally logged by authorities, with detailed notes on where and how it was found. Then it would be submitted to forensic labs equipped to analyze fibers, inks, weathering patterns, and material science. Independent experts would review the chain of custody. Only after multiple confirmations would investigators consider whether the evidence met the threshold for reopening the case. If you believe you have located evidence related to this case, there is a responsible path forward. Contact the FBI's tip line with a clear description of what you have found and where. Do not disturb the item. Do not handle it more than necessary. Photograph it in place and document the location. The Bureau will advise you on next steps. That procedure exists because evidence is fragile and its integrity is everything. Throughout this story, we have asked you to hold two things in tension: fascination with the case and respect for the real people whose names appear in public speculation. Some are no longer here to defend themselves. Others live with decades of suspicion. That awareness does not make the question less interesting. It makes approaching it carefully a matter of decency.
This case ends not with a dramatic answer, but with a process. The path toward reliable conclusions is built on measurable steps. Secure evidence. Preserve it with integrity. Submit it to independent review. And accept only conclusions that meet professional standards. If a parachute fragment or clearly documented bills reemerge, what legal and forensic steps would produce a trusted conclusion?